Hi, my name's Gary King, and I've assembled the most formidable JFK team on planet Earth. We've got Dr. James Fetzer, Larry Rivera, who is the number one researcher in the world today when it comes to new research, and we've got Don Fox, who's not afraid to look a little bit deeper than anyone else. So if you're interested in what happened to the 35th President of the United States, then I invite you to our show. It's called The New JFK Show. And it's on YouTube. Go to Gary King YouTube channel, and we've got over 90 shows archived for you there. So if you really want to know the truth, and knowing that over 9 out of 10 researchers are working the other side of the street in a sea of disinformation, I pledge to you the truth about JFK. Go to Gary King YouTube channel and find out your true history.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
We're ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, where I'm very pleased to have as my featured guest this evening a graduate of the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, who earned a degree in political science and international relations. He spent 22 years in the U.S. Navy as an officer and an aviator from 1955 to 1977. And during his period of service, he was inundated, as were the other officers and enlisted personnel, with propaganda, anti-German, anti-Russian, anti-communist. And when he had the opportunity subsequently during his life to reflect upon it, he felt that really it was inaccurate in relation to the historical record on which he has done a great deal of research and now published a book available on Amazon.com. entitled The Myth of German Villainy. His name is Benton Bradbury. Ben, welcome to The Real Deal.
Hi, Jim. Thank you.
I'm just delighted to have you here. Tell me what first inspired you to go whole hog into research on this.
Well, I have been interested in this era of history, beginning, I suppose, with World War I through the end of World War II. And I've read numerous books about it in my life. I've been a kind of a serial reader all my life. And, of course, you are bombarded, inundated, as you said, with the propaganda, and you swallow it at first, and then somehow it doesn't make sense after a while. And then I started to read books written by the other side, by civilians who experienced the war and the interwar period, enlisted men in the German army, officers in the German army, and of course they tell a completely different story, just the opposite of the one we learn in school. And after reading for years and years, I just, I think it was Napoleon who said that history is a fable agreed upon. And I think that's got to be my position.
Or a pack of lies that the living play upon the dead.
You could put it that way.
I've noticed about your book on Amazon, Ben, that it has 149 customer reviews with an average rating of 4.5 out of 5. That's quite remarkable. That means your book has received a very warm reception from the reading public. And I know from my own experience, that's a highly critical reading public. So I have to congratulate you that you must have produced an excellent book.
Well, I think people were kind of waiting for somebody to tell this side of the story. I get almost all 5 stars or 1 star, nothing in between.
I've had books like that, right. And those who wrote the 1 star principally, in my case, hadn't even read the book.
Yeah, that's, I think, probably the case with mine as well.
Ben, let's take a look at the first slide, which has the cover, which I think is rather nice. Did you have that drafted specifically for your cover?
No, I sent that picture in of the Nazi with the monocle, and I had it published by Arthur House, and Arthur House designed the cover. They did a very nice job.
They did. A very nice job indeed. Would you like to begin with your slides? You can take us through groups of them as you prefer. Just tell Chance what you'd like to have shown.
Okay, Chance, you can snap through those first three, first few. I was in the Navy for 21 years, and I was a naval aviator, flew anti-submarine helicopters at sea. Then Huey helicopters in Vietnam, and from there I went to the Navy postgraduate school. You can flip to the next one. I got a Combat Air Medal while I was out there.
Well, I'm glad you came back in one piece, man.
So you can go to the next slide, and we'll talk about the themes of my book. The book has two main themes, other themes, but two main themes. And one is the mischaracterization of Germany as history's evil nation. This is how Germany is characterized. All you have to do is go to the History Channel today, and you see it repeated over and over again.
Yes.
That simply isn't true. The Germans simply were not any more evil or brutal or anything warlike than the rest of us were. In fact, I discuss in the book that Germany was not responsible. Germany did not start World War I and didn't start World War II, but were, in fact, the victims of aggression by the Allies in both wars.
That's fascinating all by itself, Ben.
Okay, the second theme of the book is the role that organized international Jewry, the Jews, played in influencing and even driving the events of this period. The Jews have always, for centuries, I suppose, portrayed themselves as innocent victims of history, the innocent victims of history. They are constantly portraying themselves as about to be persecuted or about to be exterminated, but in reality, the Jews have just as often been the persecutors and exterminators themselves. And I'll mention what happened right after the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia.
In the course of my own research, Ben, I was surprised to discover that Judea had declared war on Germany in 1933. You never hear about that in the history books.
Exactly. But look what happened. You know, we hear about the Holocaust. Supposedly 6 million Jews were killed by the Germans in the Holocaust. That's a gross exaggeration. Even if the Holocaust occurred at all, there were not 6 million.
Well, we've done quite a bit on that. Most recently, we had a show about the purported gas chambers at Auschwitz, Ben, and none of it adds up. The facilities were redesigned. They couldn't possibly have served the function of gas chambers. I doubt there were 6 million Jews in all of Europe at the time of World War II. So we know quite a lot about it. It's a subject we've addressed many times, but please do proceed.
4.5 million, I understand, and 4.39 million of those got lifetime reparations, lifetime pensions from the German government after the war. So,
the International Committee of the Red Cross was keeping very meticulous records on the inmates at these camps, which actually weren't centers for extermination, but labor camps. And when they revised their estimate in 1993, they wound up with like 297,081, who's specifying their nationality, their ages, the cause of death. None of them died from being put to death in a gas chamber, Ben, and of course, 297,081 is a tiny proportion of the numbers that have been claimed.
I went out to Auschwitz and toured it in 1989. That's before all the tourists started to throng out there. And I checked into I'll tell you this story real quickly. I checked into my hotel, asked the maitre d' if he could supply me a tour guide that knew all the history and everything, and he introduced me to a Polish history professor who grew up in Oswiecim, which is the Polish name for Auschwitz. And we went out to Auschwitz, and he grew up there, and he took me to his little house the little row of houses just outside the fence of Birkenau. That's Auschwitz II.
Yes.
And we're standing on the front porch of his little house. Now, this man was in his mid-60s in 1989, which made him a teenager in the war, during the war. And I just read a lot about this. And so I said, how did you feel as a teenager standing here on your front porch looking out into this compound? It was just barbed wire that separated the houses outside from the inside. You could see everything, everything, just row after row of barracks-like buildings. And I said, how did you feel about all the shootings and the murder and the brutality that went on here day by day? And he said, that's nonsense. That was propaganda. He said, this was a well-organized, well-run labor camp.
Yes.
And they supplied labor to all the factories that were built just surrounding the little town of Auschwitz.
This is maybe the biggest, darkest secret of World War II, that those were actually labor camps and not centers for extermination.
Yeah. And I said, well, what about the gas chamber? He said, more propaganda. There was no gas chamber. This was in 1989, the first time I've heard anybody say that.
That's very good. You had an excellent tour guide, Ben. You were lucky.
Yeah, he was a history professor, and that's not unusual. These guys do that a lot. You know, they make more money being a tour guide than they do teaching history, so that's why.
Well, let's move forward with your slides. You have so many, I don't want to miss any of them.
Okay, yeah, let's go to the next one, the stereotype of Nazi Germany. Here's Hitler in the background with the marching soldiers. This, you know, the Germans have been characterized as this extreme militaristic, brutal, evil people who ready, willing, and able to make war on their innocent neighbors. And that is the stereotype that's been created by propaganda, Jewish propaganda primarily. But you can go to the next slide now. That only began, this image of Germany only began in World War I. Before World War I, Germany had just the opposite image in the world. It was a land of dreamy castles and fairy tales. You can just cycle through some of the other slides, if you will. Go to the next one. They were strong family units. They had strong moral Christian values. That was the culture of Germany. And it was seen that way by the rest of the world. The next slide shows a musician. They loved music. They loved folk dancing. And then the next slide shows a May Day in Germany, which shows a highly civilized, nice people. These are not evil people. Okay, now you can go to the next slide. This image of Germany, which existed through the history of Germany right up to World War I, once war was declared, Great Britain launched this horrible propaganda program against the Germans. And you can go to the next slide. And suddenly, the Germans look like this. They're brutish, knuckle-dragging Huns who like nothing better than flipping Belgian babies in the air and catching them on their bayonets. So the next slide that shows Germany as a brutish monster of a gorilla. And then the next one. Now, this is the British propaganda, anti-German propaganda. This is an American propaganda piece right here, which shows a German crucifying a British soldier, and then Americans in the background are coming to the rescue.
Yeah, and the use of crucifixion as the image is no accident, since it appeals to Christian theology.
Exactly. Okay, you can go to the next slide. There's another picture of brutish Germany. And then the next one, go to the next one, yeah. Okay, now, how did Germany come to get this reputation, and how did Germany get blamed for starting World War I and later on World War II, but first of all, World War I? And this requires a bit of explanation about how things got that way. And if you could bear with me for a couple of minutes, go back and tell. Okay, they had, after the Napoleonic Wars ended in 1815. Europe was in chaos. Did a lot of destruction and so forth. So they convened the Congress of Vienna, and a guy named Prince Metternich, who was an Austrian ambassador, was the leader of it. And they organized or established a balance of power scheme for Europe. so that they wouldn't be making war with each other. And each great power had its own sphere of influence, and it was recognized and respected by all the other powers. Now, this kept the peace in Europe for decades, and then the Franco-Prussian War erupted, which is a horrible war between France and Prussia. France started the war, by the way, about something to do with the Spanish throne, the heir to the Spanish throne. But anyway, Prussia won the war, imposed money, it got money from Germany, and it took two provinces took two provinces from France and made them part of Germany.
Man, my ancestors came from Alsace-Lorraine.
Ah, there you are. And you're German. Yeah, okay. Well, they
German-English. My mother was a waterhouse.
Okay. The population of these two provinces was 65% German-speaking ethnic Germans. So there was some justification for them doing what they did. But Otto von Bismarck, the Chancellor of Prussia, had an opportunity here to consolidate all the multiplicity of little German sovereign states, little principalities, monarchies, independent states. Germany, before the Franco-Prussian War, was kind of a geographic expression more than the name of the country. And so anyway, Bismarck was able to consolidate all these little German states into the modern nation, state of Germany. And suddenly, now this threw the balance of power scheme the kilter. Suddenly here Germany emerged with 65 million people, the largest country, nation on the continent. Now Britain had 45 million and France had 40 million by comparison. So now Great Britain was the great power at this time and had been for about 150 years, and they kept a sharp eye on the continent to make sure that there was never an accumulation of power on the continent that would rival their own. And when Germany emerged with 65 million people, boom, just what they'd been guarding against all those years suddenly was reality. But now these German people are highly intelligent, highly scientific, hard workers, and once the German state was consolidated, they began to grow exponentially, their economy, manufacturing, all kinds of scientific development, and they began to export more and more and more and began even to take over some of Great Britain's markets.
They became the economic powerhouse of Europe.
Precisely. And so this is Germany's great sin. They didn't do anything to anybody. They just were too successful. So the British started to discuss and calculate how they were one day going to bring this new upstart down to size. They started talking about an eventual war with Germany. This was in the turn of the century, in the 1890s and so forth. Now, so Great Britain had a good reason to want to go to war with Germany. Now, here's Germany succeeding, doing everything they want to do. They're building an empire like the other countries of Europe, accumulating colonies in Africa and so forth, from which they get raw materials and they can export finished goods and so on. They start building a navy, which started to rival the British navy. So Britain was starting to become obsessed with Germany and wanted to eventually saw that they were going to be forced into a war with Germany for economic reasons. Now, here's France, who had lost the Franco-Prussian War, and in their military academies and politicians and so forth, they are obsessed with one day having another war with Germany for revenge, and also to get their two provinces back. So these two countries have strong reasons to want to have a war with Germany. Now, the third of the Triple Entente that went up to war eventually against Germany was Russia. And Russia was bottled up in the Black Sea and their big naval base there at Sevastopol. And they wanted a warm water outlet through the Bosphorus Straits that went by Istanbul. This was owned by the Ottoman Empire. But the Ottoman Empire was allied with Germany, and Germany had a fleet there. And so Russia wanted to take control of the Bosphorus Straits and the city of Istanbul and saw the only way that that was possible was to have a war with Germany. So you had these three countries, the Triple Entente, that is Great Britain, France, and Russia, all having good reasons to want to go to war with Germany and having something to gain from a war. But here's Germany, who didn't want to have a war with anybody. They're succeeding beyond their greatest imaginations, just doing what they're doing. The last thing they wanted was a war. They would have gained nothing from a war. So there you are. The stage is set. The pot's boiling and bubbling. And the Triple Entente want a war with Germany. Germany is doing their best diplomatically to avoid it. So what happened? You can go to the next slide now. The heir to the Austrian throne, Franz Joseph, and his wife Sophia go down to a state visit to
Serbia. Well, you have the wrong year there, Ben. It says 1814. You mean 1914.
I'm sorry. Yeah, 1914.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. They go down for a state visit, and they're shot and killed by a guy named Gavrilo Princip. And he's a Serbian, and he's a member of a Serbian revolutionary group called the Black Hand, it turns out.
Right.
This so angered Austria that they declared their intention to go to war. They didn't actually follow through quite so fast, but they declared their intention to invade Serbia. Okay, now Russia, these are Slavic countries, they're in the Balkans, and Russia called them their little Slavic brothers and set herself up as a protectorate of these countries. So they told Austria that if Austria were to attack Serbia, that Russia would attack Austria. So Germany, because Germany's surrounded by enemies, France on one side, Russia on the other, and their friend, Austria-Hungary, on the south, if Russia were indeed to attack Austria and occupy it, Germany would be totally surrounded by enemies. And so they gave Austria the famous blank check. We're behind you. Whatever you do, we'll back you up. They did that to try to discourage the Russians from mobilizing, but it didn't work. The Russians mobilized anyway. And in those days, mobilization was tantamount to a declaration of war. And as soon as Russia mobilized, the French, who were close allies with the Russians, declared their intention to mobilize. Only then did Germany mobilize. All right. So Germany did not cause that. Now, next, let's go to the next slide. Germany is sitting on a flat plain in the middle of Europe, so with no natural barriers like mountains or White River, anything like that. And they're vulnerable to invasion and attack. And in fact, the whole history of Germany has been one of invasion from outside armies. So they had a strong military tradition. The Prussians did for that very reason. And they had developed this plan called the Schlieffen Plan after Field Marshal von Schlieffen. And this was a defensive plan in nature. And in event that they were attacked, on two sides, by Russia on one side and France on the other, they would immediately implement this Schlieffen Plan, which meant a rapid mobilization, a drive through Belgium into France, all the way to Paris, knock France out of the war, wheel around and take on the Russians. This is the only way they felt they could survive a war between themselves and France and Russia. So this was defensive in nature. And that's exactly what they did. And I think because they went in and to Belgium and attacked first is one of the reasons they get credited with starting the war. But I emphasize that it was defensive. Their enemies, the Triple Entente, were the ones who brought the war about. And as soon as Germany went into Belgium, Great Britain used that as a pretext to declare war herself. And so that is the origin of the war. And I think that explanation exonerates the Germans from being the cause of that war. Okay. You can go to the next slide. The Schlieffen Plan didn't work. The Belgians put up a resistance that the Germans didn't expect and slowed them down, and that and other reasons, they bogged down into trench warfare before they ever made it to Paris. And so it remained an immobile trench warfare throughout the rest of the war until the Americans came in. You can go to the next slide. And but it was a quite different story on the Eastern Front. The Germans left a minimal force in the trenches in France and took as many of the army as they could spare and sent them to the east to take on the Russians. And they had much better success on the east, in the east against the Russians. They won every single battle that they engaged in with the Russians. The Battle of Tannenberg was a disaster for the Russians. And you can go to the next slide. This is a picture of Germany crossing into Russia. The next picture shows, you can go to the next slide, shows the Russian army freeing the Germans as they come into Russia. Okay, let's go to the next slide then. Okay, now, Germany is winning the war on the Eastern Front. No doubt about it. And on the Western Front, they appear to be have the edge. Their submarines forces already stopped the transfer of goods from America to Britain, and they appear in position to actually win the war on the Western Front as well. So the Germans, late in 1916, make a peace offer to France and Britain, a status quo anti-peace offer. They say, let's just stop the war, pull our troops back home. Nobody wins, nobody loses. Let's end the war. And France and Britain rejected it because they went into the war in the first place to destroy Germany as an economic rival, and that was still their intention. So they rejected Germany's peace offer. Remember, Germany never wanted a war in the first place, and they tried to end the war in 1916. Next slide, please. Okay. This guy on the left is Heim Weizmann. He was the first president of the New State of Israel when it was formed. And in very shortly after the Germans made
it. You mean when it came into existence in 1948?
48, yeah. Thank you. But Heim Weizmann and a group of international Jews went to Sir Arthur Balfour, who was Britain's foreign affairs minister, and they made a proposal. Now, let me explain also that the Jews, international Jews, favored Germany in the war up to this point. And were open and vocal about it, and they were against Britain because Britain was allied with Russia, and international Jewry, one of their top items on their list was one day bringing down the Tsar and bringing down the Tsar's government because they had been oppressed in the Russian Empire and so forth. That's what caused over 2 million of them to leave the Russian Empire and move to the United States between 1881 and 1924.
So those were legitimate grievances of the Jews against the Tsar?
Well, I don't think so. The Russians had good reasons to control these people because they tend to organize together in tight groups and exploit their host populations, which is what they did in Russia and everywhere else they live. So the Russians were right to take oppressive measures against them. But anyway, they hated Russia. And so they were willing to switch sides if Great Britain, they proposed this to Balfour, would give international Jewry Palestine as a homeland for Jews after the war was over. Now, Palestine belonged to the Ottoman Empire, and if Germany won, the Ottoman Empire was Germany's ally, and they would still control Palestine. The only way that the British would be in position to hand Palestine over to the Jews would be if the allies, that is the British, won. So he said, the Jews in America, we're very close to the Jews in America, but there are powerful Jews in America who virtually control the President of the United States as well as our government. And go to the next slide, if you will.
Was it Woodrow Wilson at the time?
Yeah, Woodrow Wilson, that's correct. And he said, we're going to go, if you will promise us Palestine as a homeland for the Jews after the war, we will go to the Jews in America, these powerful Jews, and we will see if we can work together to bring America into the war on Great Britain's side, which would guarantee that they would win, and then Palestine would be in the hands of the British and available to hand over to the Jews. Okay, so with that promise, they said that we can promise you that we can bring America into the war. That's what they promised Balfour. So with that promise, the British rejected the German peace offer. These Jews, and I've got the pictures of them here. This is just some of the more prominent ones. Jacob Schiff, head of the Kuhnlo Bank, one of the richest men in the world. Paul Warburg, who was a German, born German Jew, but he was the head appointed by Wilson, the head of our Federal Reserve, the newly formed Federal Reserve. Here's Henry Morgenthau, a very wealthy financier. He was appointed by Wilson to be ambassador to Turkey. Here is Louis Brandeis. Wilson put him on the Supreme Court. Bernard Baruch, who made millions and millions as a war profiteer in World War I. He's a very powerful man. Here's Rabbi Stephen Wise, who's got the ear of Wilson. And then on the right is Felix Frankfurter, who eventually was put on the court appointed by Roosevelt. Now, these powerful Jews virtually controlled Woodrow Wilson because they had put up the money to make him first governor of New Jersey and then president of the United States. And so they had his ear. Not only that, Woodrow Wilson was already predisposed to go into the war on Germany's side. But they created a couple of pretexts. The Zimmerman telegram, I think, was one. The sinking of the Lusitania. And then these Jews who owned the Hollywood and owned the news media, virtually all of it, turned a propaganda campaign on to bring the American public around to supporting America.
The Lusitania actually was carrying weapons in its hull and therefore was a legitimate target for the U-2s, though the American public were never informed thereof.
Exactly so. Less than 6 months after these powerful Jews started working on Woodrow Wilson, America declared war on Germany. Now, we had no reason under the sun, none, to have a war with Germany. Germany had done nothing to us. Before World War I, we had close, friendly relations with Germany. So it was these guys who got America into this war. Okay, go to the next slide. Okay, once America joined the war, there was no way Germany could win against these overwhelming combination forces. And on the 11 November 1918, the Germans agreed to an armistice, and the war ended. Now, what does armistice mean? Armistice means that we'll stop the war while all sides can come up with a peace plan. Okay, next slide. Okay, no, we're not there yet. You can go back to the other one. Now, I should say something at this point. Let me see. I guess the war ended, and they had the peace conference in the Palace of Versailles outside of Paris, and they came up with the Versailles Treaty, then they called the Germans in. Now, the Germans were the honorable ones. They had pulled their army out of the war, took them back home, and they were beginning to demobilize, waiting for to work out a peace agreement. Great Britain and France maintained their armies intact. Not only that, but Great Britain, the most powerful navy in the world, had a starvation blockade around Germany, letting nothing in and nothing out, which during the course of the war and afterwards caused the deaths of nearly a million German civilians, and ruined the health of millions more. Now, after the war, this armistice was announced, they maintained this blockade for 7 months while they were working on this peace plan. And they called the Germans in and said, sign here. And the Versailles Treaty, what did it do? It gave vast areas of Germany, along with the German population to other countries. They created the country of Poland and gave them West Prussia and the supports of Silesia and the city of Danzig and so forth. Memel went to Lithuania. The Rhineland was...
Poland was created by the Treaty of Versailles?
I wouldn't say by the Treaty of Versailles. I'm not sure about that. It was created at the end of the war.
The treaty, of course, was very unjust to Germany and bred a lot of resentment on behalf of Germans and was a contributing factor thereby to World War II.
Yeah, exactly. But the Germans were called in and forced to sign. And the Germans said, no, we don't agree with this. We didn't start this war. And say, okay, we'll invade your country, France said. And we're going to maintain the starvation blockade until we sign. Finally, Germany
did. In other words, they were not dealing with honorable men.
Exactly. And Germany was forced against their will to sign this treaty, which invalidated it as a moral instrument. Germany had no moral obligation ever thereafter to comply with this treaty. And as soon as they were in position to throw it off, they had every right to do so. Okay. So there. Let's leave this alone now, and let's go back and backtrack to what's happening in Russia. So next slide, if you will. This guy in the middle holding the paper is Kerensky, Alexander Kerensky. Germany, the Russian army, the soldiers began to desert in droves, began to turn their guns on their own officers and kill them. And they were losing against the Germans. The war still was not over yet between Germany and Russia.
Kerensky made anti-Semitism a crime punishable by death?
Okay, first of all, let me say that the Tsar abdicated and Kerensky formed a provisional government. And yeah. I think I'm mistaken about this. I think this came later. He himself, I should have corrected that. He himself didn't do that, but what he did do was open up all restrictions on Jews in Russia. Now, before, Russia had not permitted Jews to be inside Russia. They had what they called the Pale of Settlement, which included the countries of Poland, Ukraine, Lithuania, Moldova, and Belarus. That was the Pale of Settlement, and all non-desirables were required to live there, including the Jews. And there were about 5 million of them, Jews, living in the Pale of Settlement. Now, after Kerensky took over the government, he lifted all restrictions on Jews. Okay, now, there had been an attempt in 1905 by Jewish revolutionaries to overthrow the Tsarist government back when Russia was at war with Japan. By the way, Jacob Schiff, head of the Cumulove Bank, funded the Japanese in that war, and he was very much determined to bring the Tsar down. This is 1905.
Schiff, whose descendants would later change their name to Bush?
Who?
Is this the same Schiff whose descendants would later change their name to Bush?
I wasn't aware of that. Didn't know about that. Could have happened. But anyway, the 1905 revolution failed. But the 1917 revolution would later on succeed. But anyway, when the 1905 revolution failed, all these revolutionary Jews were exiled out of the country, and they took up residence in Switzerland. There's a couple of million of them went to New York City. They were all over the world, Argentina and so forth. When the Kerensky government lifted all restrictions on Jews, they started to flood back into Russia, which was a momentous event. Okay, go to the next slide. Okay. Now, Lenin, the Germans got Lenin in Switzerland and 33 other people who were almost all, maybe all Jews, put them on a SEAL train, took them into the Finland station in St. Petersburg, and funded them lavishly with money. Their intent was to get them to create a revolution which would take Russia out of the war. The war was still raging between Germany and Russia at this time. So that's how Lenin got into St. Petersburg. Now, here's Trotsky, Leon Trotsky, you can go to the next slide. Here, okay, in this picture, you've got Lenin speaking and Trotsky is standing there by the podium to the right. You can go to the next slide. Leon Trotsky was living in the Lower East Side of New York. Okay, go ahead and pass that one by. We don't have time to discuss this, so just the next slide. Leon Trotsky was living in the Lower East Side. Jacob Schiff, head of the Cumlow Bank, arranged for him and about 350 other Jews from the Lower East Side to go to Russia to participate and create a revolution. And how did they get there? Now, none of them are American citizens, but Louis Brandeis, the Supreme Court, importuned upon President Wilson to have the State Department issue all these Jews from the Lower East Side with American passports to facilitate their entry into Russia. And then these Jewish banks funded these people lavishly. So Trotsky and his people arrived the day after Lenin did, and they joined forces.
This was an attempt to bring about a Jewish coup d'etat in Russia.
That's exactly what happened. And so they brought down the Kerensky government.
So the Bolshevik Revolution was actually a Jewish revolution.
Exactly. It was a Jewish revolution. Go to the next slide, please. Exactly. And I later on, I think I have a slide that a guy named Robert Wilton, maybe we'll pass that by later on, but a guy named Robert Wilton, a journalist for the Times of London, had been in Russia this whole time before, even back in the 1905 revolution and after. And he knew everything that was going on there and who was behind it all. And he obtained a list of names of the 537, I think it was, top Bolshevik leaders in the new Bolshevik government after it was formed. 457 of these, I think, were Jews. And I list that in my book. I just copy his, Robert Wilson's list and the names of all of these people, and it gives their ethnicity. Less than 100 of them were non-Jews, and almost zero were ethnic Russians. Of the non-Jews, most of them were Poles, Latvians, some Ukrainians, Georgians, and a high percentage of these significantly had Jewish wives. So they were essentially Jews themselves. So this amounted to, as you put it, a Jewish coup d'etat of the Russian state. This was an alien force who had come in and taken over the government and all of the institutions of the government of Russia.
And most of them were not even indigenous Russians. Most of them had come from other countries, many from the United States.
Well, yeah, but the ones that were in the United States had originally immigrated from the Pale of Settlement, that is Poland, Ukraine.
Yes, of course.
You're right. And many of them didn't even speak Russian. You were correct. Okay, Leon Trotsky, he's a Jew. Lenin is one quarter Jew, but he's more than that. He has a Jewish wife and they speak Yiddish in their home and their children identify as Jews. So he was really a Jewified Jew, a non-Jew, if you will. Okay, Lenin takes...
Ben, do you think there's something about Judaism? Is this Talmudic Judaism that leads... You know, that's somehow a motivating factor here in the background that needs to be understood?
Well, yeah. These Jews have no biological linkage with the Holy Land.
Right. I understand that. But yeah, go ahead.
Called Khazaria, because of the land of the Khazars that stretches and covers.
This has all been confirmed by recent DNA studies out of Johns Hopkins and other institutions of higher learning.
Exactly. Arthur Koestler wrote the book, The 13th Tribe, and I think he was one of the first ones to describe this, and I read his book. But anyway, the Khazars were a warlike tribal people, and they were a mixture, racial mixture. The land of the Khazars went all the way up to where Kiev is today and down into where Georgia is, and they were a mixture of Turkish, black-haired, curly-haired people, and blonde-haired, blue-eyed people. So that's why you get Paul Newman and people like him that are American Jews, but they look like ordinary Europeans because they have an admixture of all of these in the Jewish eyes. Anyway, they converted over to Judaism in about 850 AD. At about the same time, the Russians converted over to Orthodox Christianity for the same reasons. They were looking for a religion, a national religion. And the Khazars converted to Judaism, the Russians to Christian Orthodoxy. And the Talmud was their basic set of laws that they went by, which
the Talmud.
Yeah, and Yiddish, by the way, is a kind of a Creole language I read that the Khazars used to do business with the Germans in Central Europe. They got a lot of German words, but the grammatical structure, I understand, is different from German. A lot of people think Yiddish is an offshoot of Germany, but it's not. So anyway, that's the explanation of, and all of these Khazars eventually became the Jews that were in Central Europe, about 6 million of them, and living in the Pale of Settlement where they were.
Listen, in relation to Woodrow Wilson and the creation of the Federal Reserve, were any of the parties you're discussing involved in that creation, which of course was involved legislation passed on Christmas Eve in 1913, as I recall?
Yeah, I was in the hotel down in St. Simon's Island, I think it was, a few years ago, where they got together secretly and created the Fed. But sounds like you know a lot more about this than I do.
Well, no, we had a question coming out of the chat room about it that I wanted to insert. So,
yeah, the Jews controlled the central banks of the Western world, in Germany, Great Britain, France, everywhere. The Jews owned the central banks, and this Paul Warburg, who was the brother of, I forget his first name, but David Warburg or something like that. He was the head of the central bank in Germany, and his brother became the head of the central bank in America.
So it was, Ben, we have only 5 minutes before our break, so you may want to cover several more slides before we get.
Okay, let's go ahead. Okay, let's talk about Trotsky. He takes over the Red Army. And
you want to go to the next slide, 32.
Okay, let's go to the next slide. Let's pass him by. We don't have to.
All right.
And go next. To the next slide. They created the Cheka, the Soviets, these Jews, Bolsheviks, created the Cheka. I forget what the acronym means, but it's their terror police.
Right.
We're almost 500,000 strong. 75% of these agents were Jews. 75% of the Cheka agents were Jews. And all of these guys at the top three, were Jews. The one at the bottom, Beria, was not a Jew, but he was the head of the Cheka. And he was Jordan, Mendelian Jordan.
You're implying throughout that a sense of tribalism of Jewish identity made a difference throughout all of these developments in history.
Precisely. They were always a subversive, alternative culture inside the Western Christian culture. But they had always been kept in check.
Yep. They displayed no desire to assimilate or to become members of the culture, but rather to retain their own and to, as it were, manipulate from positions of power.
They didn't do work like farming or factory working or anything like that. They all gravitated towards finance, middlemen in trade, where they got a cut of the profits and so forth. And in fact, they turned out to be wealth extractors, not wealth creators. And they always had a parasitic relationship with the host population. They lived in.
Jesus chased the money changers from the temple.
And they had to constantly be kept in check by the governments of Western Christians.
Please go on to slide 34.
Yeah. And, okay, the Tsar abdicated the Cheka, the Jews, a group of Jewish Cheka members murdered the Tsar and his family. You can go to the next one. Next slide. This is what the Cheka looked like. They call it the glisten and squeak look. It was all leather. Next slide. Okay. Now, there's a lot more to be said, but we've got to move on here. We can't dwell too far on it. But it's important to understand that communism and Bolshevism were Jewish organizations. They were created by Jews. Communism was a Jewish creation. It was imported into America when the flood of Jews came in at the turn of the 20th century. That's how we got introduced to communism. The communist movement that took over the Soviet Union was a Jewish movement. And then the Communist International, the Comintern, was established to spread this revolt, the communist revolt throughout Europe.
And what do you understand communism to be? That it would be, you know, is there anything about communism per se? I mean, most of us have read the manifesto, for example. There are many virtues there, universal education, universal suffrage, and things like that. What would it be about communism that would be distinctively Jewish?
Well, it was Marxist, and it was kind of the secular religion of the Jews. They wanted to create what they called a dictatorship of the proletariat. They wanted to get rid of all government. They wanted to have everybody equal.
Yeah, but that has to do with a certain view about history, you know, dialectical materialism and so forth that Marx was espousing, which turns out to be historically superseded by governmental reforms, the emergence of labor unions, and a host of other issues that altered the increasing concentration of wealth in the hands of the few. Though I must say, in the United States in recent times, there's been a reversal. And since the Reagan administration, instead of having a gradual narrowing of the wealth disparity, there's been an increasing exaggeration, which Bernie Sanders, among others, has been addressing in his campaign.
Yeah, they want this naive equality, which is impossible because people are not equal, but that was their main goal. And they were going to have this dictatorship of the proletariat, which really meant a dictatorship by a Jewish elite. That's what it really meant in reality. There never was a dictatorship.
Let's look at the next three or four before we take a break, Ben.
Yeah, okay. As soon as these Bolshevik Jews got total control of the Russian government, there was a lot of resistance among the people. And they launched this reign of terror, this red terror, and established the Cheka to carry it out. And they set about, their goal was to create this dictatorship of the proletariat, which meant that they had to eliminate the bourgeoisie. There was a very small middle class in Russia at that time. There was the bourgeoisie, which was the upper class, and then the proletariat and the peasants were the workers and the farmers. And they set about to kill the bourgeoisie, and they did it systematically. They killed them because of their class. They set these Cheka.
How can you have a society without, as it were, a business class? I mean, aren't the bourgeoisie principally the businessmen, the merchants, the small business owners?
That's what made it stupidly unworkable. The Jews planned, in fact, if they didn't even believe it themselves or say it, they planned themselves to be this new elite to take the place of the murdered bourgeois.
Let's go to the next slide, Chance.
Yeah.
But the next one after that. Yeah, these are deaths during this slaughter.
They slaughtered tens of millions of people.
And there are a couple more. Go to the next one, yes.
And these are just pictures of slaughtered people.
And another, yes, yes, yes.
You can go to go right on through this series. Here's a brutality shown. Go to the next one. Okay, now they tried to round the kulaks and the peasants up off their private farms onto a collective farm. This was one of their programs. And the Ukrainians especially resisted this. They did not want to cooperate, and didn't cooperate. So they created this starvation thing that occurred in 1932 and 1933 called the Holodomor, and Stalin's brother-in-law, Kaganovich. You can go ahead and cycle through these.
Yeah, let's do three more slides at least. Yes, starving Ukrainian children.
Ukrainians.
That's pretty bad.
As many as 9, so they estimate between 7 and 9 million Ukrainians starving.
More chance, more, yeah.
Yeah. And go to the next one. And this is the guy, Kaganovich, a Jew, who was put in charge of this program.
Is this a good place to take a break, Ben?
Yeah, it is.
All right. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my special guest, Ben Bradbury. We're discussing the history of Germany in World War I and World War II. We'll be right back.
Moonrock Books. We're a group of scholars, experts, and authors who feel the world really needs saving, and that resisting the American Empire is the right thing to do. People are starved for truth. They are given lies. They subsist on lies, but it's not really living. People are not watching TV news. They're ceasing to read newspapers, too, because they know by now they will not find it there. The biggest battle being fought anywhere is with information. If the people can receive the truth, they will do the right thing. We are publishing the truth about Sandy Hook, about the Boston bombing, about the moon landings, about the Holocaust, and much, much more. The truth. It falls upon us to fight the empire and save the world. Join us, Moonrock Books.
Less than 3% of you people read books, because less than 15% of you read newspapers. Right now, there is a whole, an entire generation that never knew anything that didn't come out of this tube. This tube can make or break presidents, popes, prime ministers. Television is not the truth. Television is a circus, a carnival, a traveling troupe of acrobats, storytellers, dancers, singers, jugglers, sideshow freaks, lion tamers, and football players. We deal in illusions, man. None of it is true. But you people sit there day after day, night after night, all ages, colors, creeds.
Broadcasting live on network radio.
So turn off your television sets. Turn them off, pal. Turn them off and leave them off.
Say with moral certainty and considerable scientific authority that the death of JFK was committed by a meticulously executed conspiracy which was obscured by an extensive cover-up. Murder in Dealey Plaza, edited by James Fetzer, goes to the heart of the JFK assassination. You'll read new and up-to-date information regarding the Secret Service, the Lincoln limousine, the medical evidence, the cover-up, altering the film, framing the patsy, and the silent historians. Also, 16 smoking guns, each one crushing the government's lone assassin scenario. A world-class chronology of November 22nd, 1963. Chapters by David W. Mantic, Gary Aguilar, Vincent Palomara, Douglas Weldon, Jack White, Ira David Wood III, James H. Fetzer, Doug Horn, and a classic essay by Bertrand Russell. The complete story in the pages of one single book, edited by James H. Fetzer. Read it now. Read it again. You'll use it as a reference. Murder in Dealey Plaza. Available at Amazon.com and major bookstores around the world. It's murder.
We'll be right back.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
You ready to make to come to the microphone so we'll listen in.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, continuing my conversation with Ben Bradbury about the non-villainy of Germany. Contrary to what the history books present, we're getting a very different view of what appear to be the realities, which was actually going on as opposed to the propaganda. Ben, please pick up. Your last slide was Stalin's brother-in-law.
Okay, let's go to the next slide. We left off with the Bolsheviks taking complete control. Let's go to the next slide, please.
Yeah.
Taking complete control of Russia and creating the Soviet Union. Now, they create the Comintern, the Communist International, for the purpose of exporting revolution to Europe. And they set up a communist party in every country in Europe, this Comintern, with headquarters in Russia and in the Soviet Union. And they work through the Jewish communities in each of these countries. As I said before, Judaism and communism is one and the same thing. They set up these communist parties, and most of the membership, not all, but most, but all the leadership and so forth of these communist parties were Jews. And their purpose was to bring down existing regimes in European countries and replace them with Bolshevik regimes led by Jews. And the first place they had a success was in Hungary. And this guy,
Bela Kun.
Moritz Cohen was his real name, was sent in, and I guess I didn't make the story short. He took control of the country of Hungary, and he created this all-Jewish regime. Even all the provincial governors or commissioners were Jewish. Even one of them had been a janitor in a synagogue. That's how completely, okay, they set about immediately to burn down, destroy the churches. They rounded up occurred in Russia, in the Red Terror. They rounded up priests and nuns by the thousands and killed them. They burned thousands of churches, the big cathedrals and so forth. They used them as warehouses and this kind of
stuff. They murdered vast numbers of priests and nuns?
And
was that to extinguish the influence of Catholicism?
That's right, but they didn't burn down the synagogues. The same thing occurred when Bela Kun took over Hungary. They burned down the churches and they killed, rounded up the priests and nuns and shot. And they collectivized all the agriculture and so forth. Well, a guy named Miklos Horthy, who had been an admiral in the Hungarian Navy, formed an army and came in and pushed these bastards out.
Let's keep going to the slides.
Yeah, going to the next slide. Now, they tried the same thing. This is Miklos Horthy. Go to the next one, please.
Well, here's that Hungarian admiral who led a counter-revolution.
That's right. He took Hungary back from these Bolshevik Jews, and they saved Hungary from the Bolshevik Jews. Okay, let's go to the next slide. We've got these guys. Kurt Eisner set up a Bolshevik government in Bavaria. He was assassinated. This guy, another Jew, Eugene Levine, took his place, and they had a Jewish...
Go ahead, Ben. Your voice was broken up there.
Oh, okay. Now, the Freikorps, which were German army units that had returned from World War I but had not disbanded, and they were not in the pay of the government, but maintained their existence to fight these communists. They were patriotic Germans, and they're the ones who saved Germany from being taken over by Bolshevik Jews. I go to the next frame. Now, put these pictures here because these people are Jews, and this was a Jewish movement, and that's what we need to understand. This is Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht, who created the Spartacus Revolution in Berlin. They were also overthrown by the Freikorps and saved Berlin and Germany from, okay, the next slide, please, from the Bolshevik takeover. Now, this is a picture of the Freikorps. You can go to the next slide. Okay, the same thing occurred in Italy. A group of communist Jews attempted to take over the country of Italy. Mussolini mounted a defense against them, drove them out, and saved Italy from the takeover.
So you're saying Mussolini was a nationalist patriot who was seeking to preserve the integrity of Italy from a takeover by outside forces inimical to the best interests of the nation.
But he's portrayed today as a nasty Nazi, or rather a fascist, and we ought to be treating him as a hero of Western Christian civilization. Okay, go to the next one. Okay, then we have the Spanish Civil War. Now, one thing in my reading and connecting all the dots over the years is I always thought of these as separate events. And it became clear, finally, that they're all interrelated in a series of related events.
Yeah, Mussolini, Franco, and ultimately Hitler were all seeking to preserve the integrity of their own nations from domination by outside forces.
Led by Jewish communists in all cases, every case. Okay, let's go. Franco saved Spain, Mussolini saved Italy. And now, here, this is something that most people do not understand. When we have to go back after this, but the Sudetenland of Czechoslovakia was taken over and attached to Germany. There are 3.2 million Germans living there. You know, they had the Munich Agreement and the appeasement thing that everybody talks about now. Well, this is, Hitler went in after Czechoslovakia had fallen apart. The two remaining provinces were Bohemia and Moravia, with Prague as the capital city. There were 188,000 Jews living in Prague. Most all communists or communist sympathizers in connection with the Comintern ready to make Moravia and Bohemia a communist state. Hitler said no, and he made it a protectorate. And that's why John McCain and all these others nowadays talk about appeasement. They say Hitler went back on his word when he agreed to not to go any further into Czechoslovakia than just to attach the Sudetenland. He did it. He made Czechoslovakia a protectorate, and that's but he did it for good reasons. He saved Europe from communist invasion. And so go to the next slide.
Yeah, I think the points you're making about the extent to which communism and the Bolshevik Revolution were actually Jewish movements is terribly, terribly important. And I don't think the Western world, at least not contemporarily, has an understanding of this relationship. I don't think it's taught to our students. It's certainly history I never learned. But assuming you're correct in your points, it's of enormous importance to understand even today's world.
But they're not, the universities are not allowed to teach it. You couldn't possibly get a textbook that would include this stuff. It's a cover-up. Okay, now let's see. We had these heroes that saved Europe. They were a bulwark against an invasion of Bolshevism into Europe. So let's not cover this. Let's go to the next one.
Well, here, I mean, you're talking about the Treaty of Versailles, which set the background for World War II because of German resentment and its abuse by the powers that claimed to be the victors and dictated the terms and impose them on Germans.
Yes, that's exactly right. And Hitler devoted his life, even as a soldier, just getting out of the army. He joined the National German Workers' Party, became its head at a very young age, changed it to the National Socialist
workers. They even took the German merchant fleet and their locomotives?
Yes.
And they weren't allowed to have a Navy and Air Force, tanks, heavy weapons? That's shocking. They really were gutting the country militarily.
Only 100,000 men were allowed in their armed forces. But think about it. The war was waged against Germany because this upstart new country had become a great power on the continent. Disturbed everybody. They went in to destroy this new upstart. And then the Versailles Treaty was written to hold Germany down so that she would never be a great power again.
This casts a very unflattering light on France and England especially.
As well it should, yes. Okay, next slide, please. Now the Weimar government that was formed right after the end of the war, the Kaiser went across the border to live in the Netherlands, and they formed a republic called the Weimar Republic because they had revolution going on in Berlin. They had to move the government to Weimar, a town. That's how it got that name. But they lifted all restrictions on Jews when they formed the Weimar government. The Kaiser had kept Jews strictly out of the government, wouldn't let them in at all. They lifted all restrictions on Jews in the Weimar government, and they flooded in. And the way Jews operate is that if a Jew can get into a government office and he has the power to hire people, he one by one surreptitiously brings in Jews.
Would you describe this as a form of tribalism?
Exactly. Until they purge all the Gentiles out and they have complete control. And that's what happened in Weimar government. It's happening in our own country today. But it's happened in Weimar government. And they go to the next slide, please. They took control. Okay, there was a stab in the back theory. Let's go past that. We don't have time.
Well, you've implied it.
Okay, the stab in the back theory. The Germans, the Jews turned against Germany and started to support the Allies at the end of the war. They withheld, finance, cut off finance to the government. They caused strikes in the factories and so forth. And the Germans had the belief that these Jewish leaders caused them to lose the war, but that's not quite true. Once the Americans came in, they had no possibility of winning the war, but they did undermine the German government, and they called that the stab in the back, and the Germans were very resentful of the Jews over it, causing intense anti-Semitism. Now, next slide. One of the things the Versailles Treaty called for were horrendous reparations payments to be paid mainly to France and Belgium, but $33 billion in 1918, what's that, trillions today. But anyway, there was no possibility that Germany could pay this. They didn't have the money to pay it, but the Allies, the British and the French, insisted that they pay it anyway, and the French threatened to invade the country if they didn't. So the Germans resorted to printing money in order to pay these reparations payments. And this got out of control. It caused a spiraling inflation so that, you've heard this before, it took a wheelbarrow full of marks just to buy a loaf of bread. The people would get paid three or four times a day and run to a store to buy anything just to get rid of the marks and buy something of value. Finally, the whole economy was on the point of collapsing. People started to sell their personal goods just to buy enough food to feed their families, and they traded their furniture, their appliances, their clothing, everything into pawn shops.
That's catastrophic, man.
Catastrophic. Now, the pawn shops were owned by Jews, and the people knew it and started to resent the hell out of it, and that caused anti-Semitism. But here's something bigger. People who had access to foreign capital, particularly American dollars, and these were the Jews who controlled finance in Germany and all throughout Europe, had access to American dollars. And as the marks filed out of control, people had to sell their farms and their homes and any property they had. And the Jews came in. You could buy a German farm for 150 or 200 American dollars. And by the time this inflation was over, Jews in Germany, who were 0.9% of the population, less than 1%, wound up owning 1/3 of German real estate. Unbelievable. This was the largest transfer of wealth from one group, Germans, to another group, the Jews, that it ever occurred in German history.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go to the next slide. This shows the worthless Marx. Okay.
Chance.
Next slide, please, Chance. Yeah, okay. Germany came unmoored from their traditional standards and morality and so forth. And the Weimar Republic became a hedonistic hell pit of sexual depravity created by Jews. They owned the nightclubs, they controlled prostitution, they controlled pornography, they controlled everything. And the American movie and play, Broadway play, Cabaret, portrayed that to some extent. Now, you can go to the next slide. This is another picture showing the debauchery that existed in Germany at the time. Formerly, well-to-do people, women and their daughters, sold themselves as prostitutes just to live because the economy was in such a state of collapse. Okay, the next slide, you can skip over it, go to the next one. This is Cabaret, we know about that. Okay, go to the next one. Okay, now these were the conditions that existed in Germany at the time Hitler became chancellor.
How did Hitler become conspicuous to the administration of the government in the first place?
Well, he'd been campaigning since he was got out of the army back there, and he had made a speech in 1919, and I've got it here on the screen, whereas he laid out his 25 points, which was his platform for what
he... Should we go to the next slide then?
And hope. Wow. Okay, so let me... I know this is kind of long, but if I could read these 25 points in a speech in 1919, he knew that early what he wanted for Germany, and it was not an evil concept. Let me just read something. He says, the unity of all German-speaking peoples in one country, the abolition of the Treaty of Versailles. These were all the things that he was for and against.
Just read it, yeah.
Land and colonies to feed Germany's population, Lebensraum. They want to go out into the East side. Only Germans can be citizens. No Jews can be a German citizen. People in Germany who are not citizens, that is the Jews, must obey special laws for foreigners. Only German citizens can vote, be employed, or hold public office. Citizens, that is ethnic Germans, are entitled to a job and a decent standard of living. If this cannot be achieved, foreigners with no rights of citizenship, which included the Jews, should be expelled from the country. No further immigration of non-Germans can be allowed into Germany. All non-German foreigners who came into, which included the Jews, came in since 1914, are to be expelled. All citizens have equal rights and duties. The first duty of a citizen is to work. All payments to unemployed people should end. All profits made by profiteers during the war must be confiscated. This is a swipe at the Jews. Nationalization of trust, meaning big corporations, should be nationalized. Large companies must institute profit-sharing plans with their employees. This is part of the socialistic, national socialism. Old age pensions must be increased. Public help for small businesses, large department stores, must be closed down. Another swipe of the Jews are the ones who own the department stores. Property reform to give small farmers their land. Again, the Jews had taken control of much of the real estate in Germany. An all-out battle against criminals, profiteers, etc., who must be punished by death. So they were cracking down on crime. Reform of the law to make it more German. Improve education so that all Germans can get a job. Improve people's health by making the law for people to participate in sports, abolition of the professional army and a new people's army in its place. German newspapers must be free of foreign, that is Jewish influence, freedom of religion, strong central government with unrestricted authority. That was his platform beginning in 1919. When he became chancellor, that was still his platform. He became chancellor in January of 1933. Now, what was the happening in Germany? They had 30% unemployment. 30%. The United States had 20%. 250,000 Germans had committed suicide in the 3 years before Hitler came into office out of despair. The birth rate had gone to zero. There was no birth rate. People were starving to death. So anyway, Hitler becomes chancellor, and he's powerless. You've got multiple political parties all squabbling, working at cross purposes.
And of course, most of these were consequences of the Treaty of Versailles, which was deliberately punitive, and essentially, you know, divested Germany of the resources it needed to be a successful economy.
That's right. And you had all the provinces that made up the state of Germany, the nation state of Germany, were still ruled by the old monarchies and principalities and the ruling families when Germany was consolidated. So Hitler wanted to disband all of these and put in cops. Anyway, he hadn't done this yet. But these were things that needed to be done. No decisions to be made. He himself was powerless to make any decision to correct anything.
I think it's fairly astonishing that he had such a broad, far-reaching, and encompassing program to put Germany back on its feet again.
Yeah, but he was powerless to do anything. It's almost like in our own Congress today. Nobody can make a decision, because the legislative process was in disarray. So he went before the Reichstag on March 23rd, the year in 1933, and he made a speech, and he said, "German people, give me 4 years of authority, that is dictatorial authority, so that I can make decisions to correct these problems that have to be corrected in order to revive Germany." And so the Reichstag gave it to him overwhelmingly, and they called it the Enabling Act. You can go to the next slide. Now, the very next day, March 24th, after his speech, international Judea declares war on Germany. A financial war, and a war of boycott. And they organized boycotts in every city in Europe and America where there were significant Jews against German goods. The central bank cut off funding to the German government. They cut off funding to trade. The Jews were owned a lot of the shipping. They wouldn't permit shipping in German ships. Their objective was to bring down the already shaky German economy. Now, they just taken over Russia, so this was not an idle threat. Okay, next slide. And in the next one, these are boycotts that they organized. And the next one. Okay, so Hitler is armed now with the Enabling Act. He has dictatorial powers. First thing he started to do was purge all the Jews out of the German government. And then he started to limit their control and power in other institutions.
Now tell me this, Ben. After the Balfour Agreement, what was the status of Palestine? There was a Jewish area under British protection. Was that the situation at that point?
That's exactly right. And this, in the Jewish government down in Palestine, wanted to bring in, these were the Zionists, wanted to bring in as many Jews as possible and get them down in Palestine, or they couldn't create a homeland for the Jews or the state of Israel. So actually, these people, these Jewish people in Palestine worked together with National Socialist Germany, with the Germans pushing on one end and the Jews...
Because they actually supported Jewish immigration to Palestine.
That's right. They were pulling on
the Jews themselves favored it.
Exactly. And so this is a coin that was struck in commemoration of that cooperation, by the way, that was occurring down there. Now, Germany.
So it's got the Star of David on one side and the
swastika
on the other. That's quite a remarkable coin, man.
But the German government set up a bank in Palestine, so that the Jews living in Germany who would immigrate to Palestine could transfer all of their wealth.
What was that coin made of? Do you know what metal?
I don't know.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So it was not true that the people had to escape over the mountaintop in the middle of the night, you know.
Well, it's not even true that the Jews regarded it as a form of expulsion. It was in way, it was exodus to the promised land.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So anyway, the Germans were encouraging the Jews to immigrate out of Germany, and Palestine was pulling them in. And so the end result of this was that they had 500,000 Jews in Germany by the 1940. They had only 160,000 left. And Austria had 190,000 at the time of the Anschluss. And by the 1940, they had only 40,000 left.
And most of them emigrated to Palestine.
Palestine and the United States and other places. Okay, next slide. Okay, I'm sorry. This shows.
This is out of sequence. That's okay.
Standing in line to get a job. Go ahead to the next one. Okay, now, what did Hitler do? He, to bring about re-employment. The first thing he did, the Jews cut off all financing, so he says, we don't need their bank. The government will print the money. And we'll use not gold, since we don't have any gold, but we'll use the labor as the value behind the new German money. So they printed the money, and they didn't have any debt because the way central banks work is they print money and they lend it to the government at interest, the way it works here in America. And so since the government printed the money, they didn't accumulate any debt. Now, what else did he do?
I think that's why North Dakota, I believe, has its own state bank and is the only solvent state in the Union as a consequence.
Yeah, Ron Paul has been advocating the United States do the same thing. Get rid of the central bank and have the government.
Yeah, of course. Absolutely.
Just like the Germans did at this time. Okay, he set up a barter system.
Well, that's called sensible financial structure for a government.
Exactly.
That it not be beholden to bankers. You know, JFK had instructed the Department of the Treasury to print hundreds of millions of United States notes on the ground that it was absurd for the government to have its currency printed by a consortium of private banks to which it paid interest. JFK saw the problem. LBJ reversed it.
Jewish-owned central bank.
it was one of the reasons he was taken out.
That's exactly right. Okay, so Hitler and his group, they surrounded himself.
And they built the Autobahn and the VW, the people's car.
Exactly. They set up a barter system for trade since they've been cut off, their financing had been cut off.
And you see a model bug right there.
Yeah, Hitler, by the way, drew that himself, designed that car.
Hitler designed the bug?
Yeah, he designed
it. That's fascinating.
Henry Ford, who was a big admirer of Hitler, came over and served as an advisor on how to set up their mass production lines.
Uh-huh.
Produce this car very cheaply. Let's go to the next slide. Okay, he banned labor unions and put they built Dachau, the concentration camp or whatever you called it, and he put all these labor leaders in Dachau. He banned the Communist Party and he arrested all the leaders and put them in Dachau. He banned all.
Let me ask you about this. I mean, historically in capitalistic societies, labor unions have been a form of collective bargaining to improve the wages and working conditions of the employees of companies. In this case, it wasn't necessary because it was the government was running the economy?
Yeah, that's right. These labor unions inevitably become extortionist anyway.
This is an awfully important point, man.
Yeah.
To understand about a difference between a socialistic and a capitalistic. Capitalistic societies tend to be inherently exploitative because they want to pay the least wages and exploit the environment with the least cost of materials and evade the most taxes to maximize profit.
But they're also in competition for other employers for labor, and so that tends to keep the...
Unless there are monopolies at work.
But what Hitler did was set up a labor front, and he put this guy in a hat there, Dr. Robert Ley, in charge of it. And they set the wage level, for everybody a fair wage level and allowed these factories to revive. Okay, he set up a HIPAA also under Helmar Schalk, his financial advisor, set up this system of policy of autarky, and that's an economic term which means economic self-sufficiency. So Hitler says anything that can be made in Germany will be made in Germany, regardless of how much it costs to make it. And he erected a tariff wall to protect these factories inside Germany. And immediately, the factories all went back to work again. Pat Buchanan is advocating that today. Paul Kent, Craig Roberts, any number of other level-headed people say we should do the same in this country today.
Isn't that fascinating?
Have a tariff wall to revive our factories. That's what Hitler did. And almost overnight, the factories went back to work again, and unemployment went to a very low level.
So we need to constrain the manufacturers who are doing their labor in other nations and, of course, depleting the workforce in the United States, which is what Donald Trump has been proposing.
Yeah, when they compare Donald Trump to Hitler, they're right, but not for the reasons they think.
Right. They want all the negative connotations, not the positive ones.
Now here, what happened? What were the results of these policies of Hitler? Within 2 years, the unemployment rate went from 30% down to 2%. Within 3 years, they had a labor shortage.
That's fantastic.
This was before rearmament began. So the rearmament, a lot of people say, oh, that's because he rearmed, that's why it happened. That isn't true. Rearmament only occurred later on.
Well, rearmament's expensive, too. I mean, it's not inherently wealth productive.
That's right. So at the same time Hitler was doing this, over in America under Roosevelt, even as late as 1940, we still had 19% unemployment rate. And all of Roosevelt's policies, none of them worked to end the depression. Whereas Hitler worked magic. And he was recognized.
How was he such an economic genius that he saw how to put the pieces together to make it work?
I think it's common sense. He used common sense. Right now, you hear the most idiotic explanations for why we need free trade in this country. When what we need is a tariff wall so that...
Yeah, free trade is just a way of making the corporations richer at the expense of the rest of the nation.
Exactly. And he knew that, and the people who argued against it, he had already put in Dachau, that is the Jews who ran the finance in the country and the labor unions and so forth. So anyway, by the middle of the 1930s, the German people had the highest, they'd gone from starvation, mind you, 30% unemployment when he came into office. Within 5 years, no, less than that, 3 years, Germany had the highest standard of living in the world, and I read somewhere, I haven't confirmed this, but I read somewhere that they also had the highest incidence of private ownership of cars in the world, the Volkswagen. And this was in Germany. This was a magical turnaround of the German economy, and the German people adored Hitler. They loved him.
Well, look what he did for them.
That's right, but at the same time, the anti-Nazi, anti-Hitler propaganda in the Jewish press, and they controlled the papers all over the Western world, were calling Germany a charnel house of oppression and brutality, where people were losing all their rights. Nothing could have been further from the truth. Nothing.
This is very important, Ben, yes. The virulent propaganda, when Hitler was actually salvaging the country and restoring its economic integrity, To be denigrating that is an outrage. Clearly, pure propaganda.
Exactly. Let's go to the next slide. This shows the book burning. Once the Jews had their fingers pried off control of the German institutions, they rounded up all these pornographic and filthy books and communist literature, and they burned it. And this has been held up as a barbaric act, but in fact it was a cleanup act in Germany.
So actually the promotion of propaganda, of pornography, and maybe a host of you know, bisexuality and so forth, homosexuality and so forth, can become an instrument to subvert the integrity of a culture.
That's right. Deliberately so, and it's happening in this country today. Okay.
It's been going on for quite a long time, Ben.
Quite a long time. I read Kevin MacDonald's books. Have you read Kevin MacDonald's books?
I know Kevin MacDonald.
Oh, you do. Okay, next slide, please. Okay. And he holds this big Nuremberg rally. All this stuff is designed to boost the morale of the German people, and it works magically. Go ahead through the next set of slides. You can cycle on through. Okay, this shows Hitler's relationship with the German people. They loved Hitler, and Hitler loved them. Ein Reich, Ein Volk, Ein Führer, he said. One state, one nation, one people.
Keep going, Chance.
This shows Hitler was a kindly man. He loved animals and loved children. Yet he's portrayed as the most evil monster of history. Not true at all. Okay, go on. Okay, he was even portrayed in 1938, and actually the January issue of Time magazine, as the man of the year for 1938. Time was owned by Henry Luce, who was a Gentile, by the way. Go ahead on to the next one. Here's shows Hitler. Hitler is made out to be a cultist and all this kind of stuff. Just go into the Hitler History Channel and you can see all this stuff even today. In fact, he grew up a Catholic and he was a believer. And if he was not a total believer in the supernatural aspects of the Christian religion, at least he valued Christianity as the foundation stone of the German culture.
We have 15 minutes.
Okay, go on to the next one. Okay, Hitler set about now to throw off the Versailles Treaty. This was his plan from the beginning, and he's been accused with every act that he committed of as proof that he intended to conquer Europe and conquer the world. He begins by announcing that he's going to rearm Germany, and this was in 1935. Go ahead. And then violation of the Versailles Treaty. He then goes in March of 7th of 1935. He crosses over the bridge with his army and reoccupies the Rhineland. Now, the Rhineland is the industrial heart of Germany, always belonged to Germany, but the Versailles Treaty said it couldn't be militarized. And this is the place where the city of Cologne and Bonn exist, very German areas. So he took back control of the Rhineland. Go to the next one.
Roughly the heartland of Germany.
The heartland of Germany. Then there is the Anschluss, which means the annexation of Austria. This is portrayed in the propaganda as an army marching in and brutally annexing another nation into Germany. That's not how it happened. 87% of the Austrian people and nearly as many of the German people wanted to reunite. And it was forbidden by the Allies and also the Versailles Treaty. So they go ahead to the next one. This shows the reaction of the Austrian people to the German soldiers. The next one, please. They don't look like they're unhappy about the Germans coming in. The next one, this shows Hitler's arriving in Austria to cheering, screaming, welcoming crowds. Next one, please. The people who didn't approve of the Anschluss were the Jews, because they were in a declared war against Germany, and it was still going on. And so the Jews were disenfranchised very quickly in Austria, and most of them immigrated out. And go ahead to the next slide. And I have said already that by the 1940, there were only 160 Jews remaining in Germany out of 500 previously, and only 40,000 out of 192,000. Let's go to Czechoslovakia. Czechoslovakia was a artificial state cobbled together out of some of the remnants of the old Austro-Hungarian Empire. They had several ethnic groups, incompatible ethnic groups, including 3.2 million Germans living in the Sudetenland. That's the brown area there bordering Germany. These Germans wanted to join Germany, and Germany wanted to welcome them in. But the Allies wouldn't permit it, because their aim of the Versailles Treaty and the war was to destroy Germany as a great power.
Right, dismember Germany and prevent its reunification.
That's right. So they were against it. Okay, next slide. Hitler said that he would welcome the Sudeten Germans in and would march in and take possession of the Sudetenland. So they had a meeting in Munich with all the leaders of Europe, including Chamberlain of England, and here he is shaking Hitler's hand. And they agreed to permit the Sudetenland to be attached to Germany, but you can't go any further. This was appeasement, the famous appeasement thing. Go ahead to the next one. He came back to England as a hero. He peace for our time. He prevented war. Next one, please. The person who vehemently objected to it was Winston Churchill. And why did he object to it? Winston Churchill is called the hero of Western civilization, like Hitler is the evil monster. But that's a false picture of Churchill, too. In fact, Churchill was a psychopathic warmonger in reality. And he was in the pay of the Jews. And that's what this cartoon shows. There was a group called the Focus, which was a group of Jews, the wealthiest Jews in Great Britain. And they paid Winston Churchill, and they supplied the money for his lavish lifestyle.
How well established and documented is this point, Ben? This is very important.
Even the Jewish, what's his name? I read his book, writer, historian today. I can't remember his name right now. He even said that the Focus was a Jewish group. It's well documented.
No. I mean that Winston Churchill was basically on the payroll.
It's well documented. I can't remember the Jewish author's name. He's a very famous Jewish historian in Britain today. I wish I could think of it, but he covered in his book about it, called Churchill and the Jews, was the name of the book.
Okay,
let's go on to the next one. So Churchill vehemently objected, and he wanted war with Germany, actually. And now, what is this? This is the Sudeten Germans. Go ahead to the next one. They're welcoming the Germans in. Here is Hitler in a town in Moravia, where they're saying, we thank our Führer for saving Czechoslovakia from a Jewish Bolshevik takeover. Okay, next. All right, now, these warmongers in Great Britain and also in America, the Roosevelt administration, very hostile to Hitler and the National Socialists. And they accuse him, show that every one of these steps that he took, he can't be trusted. But in fact, he spelled out exactly what he wanted to do as early as 1919 in his 25-point speech. The last piece of the puzzle to make Germany whole again was the land that was ceded to Poland, the Polish corridor. Now, what happened, the city of Danzig was 96 or 98% ethnic Germans, but it was not given to Poland. It was, Poles controlled it and occupied it and used the port facilities, but it was under the supervision of the League of Nations, technically. But Hitler wanted Danzig back.
Well, it's a very, even looking at the map, it's a very peculiar geographical arrangement, clearly artificial.
Yeah, okay. Now, what the Polish corridor did there, the gray part, is separate East Prussia from Germany.
Yeah, East and West Germany, roughly.
Yeah, but the East Prussians were not allowed to cross the Polish corridor to get to Germany or the other way either. They had to go by boat.
What a ridiculous artificial constraint. Clearly punitive, vindictive, and intended to undermine the integrity of the German state.
But Hitler was a moderate man, and he was well aware of the hostility that existed between the Polish people and the German people, so he was cautious. He said, I won't claim the Polish corridor back for Germany. What I would like to do is build a railroad and a highway, an elevated railroad and a highway across the Polish corridor to reconnect East Prussia. And I want the city of Danzig back. And we'll give the Poles the use of the port facilities in Danzig. That's all he asked for. And Churchill and the British warmongers and Roosevelt and his warmongers all, go to the next slide if you please.
They were all opposed.
All opposed to Poland agreeing to cooperate. Go to the next slide. Poland to cooperate in this demand.
Chance,
the next slide. Okay, this guy was a marshal of Poland. His name is Edvard Rydz-Smigiel. He was a megalomaniacal, militaristic guy who, now, this is an important thing to understand. Poland at this time, Poland in 1920, the Polish army, had defeated the Red Army. Poland was a significant military force at this time that Germany was negotiating for the highways across the Polish corridor. Their army was actually bigger than the German army. Now, the German army was still rebuilding after the Versailles Treaty had them down to 100,000 troops. Go to the next slide, please. The Polish army, next slide, please.
Were the Allies looking with concern upon the remilitarization of Germany?
They were equipped as equally as well as the German army. So it was this image of an overpowering, overwhelming Germany threatening the weak little Poland was nonsense. The Poles were just as belligerent, more belligerent than the Germans were, far more. Okay, next slide. Chance, are you with us? Okay. Now, they were agitating for war between Poland and Germany. Next slide.
Wait, this is very important here, Ben. Mm-hmm. Go back. You're saying Winston Churchill and Lord Halifax wanted Poland to not cooperate with Germany in settling these matters between Poland and Germany. They oppose it.
Exactly. And then it's next slide. So did Roosevelt and his administration. They both encouraged Rydz-Smigiel to refuse to negotiate any further with Germany and don't concede anything.
How much was Roosevelt involved in this?
Well, surprisingly, he was even more belligerent than the British were for reasons. The reason he was is because his administration was occupied virtually by Jews that were openly sympathetic to the Soviet Union.
And unsympathetic to Germany.
Unsympathetic to Germany. That's right. Hostile. Not unsympathetic.
Yeah.
Hostile.
Yeah. Not merely unsympathetic, but actively negative.
Yeah, because of the measures that Hitler and his regime had taken against the Jews in Germany, the American Jews were very hostile to Germany. Okay, so they agitated for the Poles to resist cooperating. Now, the Germans even gave... Now, go to the next slide, if you please. Okay, Morgenthau, Henry Morgenthau, Secretary of the Treasury. He was warmongering for war between anybody in Germany. Next slide. Next slide.
Kennedy.
Okay, this is Joseph E. Kennedy, the father.
Now go back, Jack, you went too fast.
Let me just say something about him. He was horrified at the idea of America or anybody going to war against Germany. He thought Germany hadn't done anything to provoke a war. He was sympathetic to Germany, and he was soon kind of forced
out. He was the ambassador to Great Britain, so he was getting pressured on both sides. By the British, who wanted to put pressure on Germany, wanted Poland to resist, and by the Roosevelt administration, which was more sympathetic to anti-German interests than it was to those of Germany. Where Joe comes out looking pretty good here, if you ask me, man. It looks to me like he was more objective and equitable in his attitude than most of the other parties.
That's right. But he resigned under pressure because he was out of
sight. He was in an intolerable situation.
Exactly. Okay, next slide. Okay, we have to move along here.
No, you listen to me, man. You want to just bring us up to the verge of World War II, and we'll do a part two. In other words, we cannot do it all tonight. We aren't going to make any effort to do it all tonight. I want you to find in the next set of slides, you know, the best part to cut off part one, okay?
Okay, well, let's talk about the Molotov-Ribbentrop agreement. the Russians and the Germans were natural enemies and had been. They saw themselves as natural enemies, and a lot of people talked that a war between them was inevitable eventually. And Hitler was kind of a bulwark against the Soviet Union moving into Europe. But they made a truce here because Germany couldn't work out agreements with Britain and France, mainly Britain. So they made a truce, a non-aggression pact between the Soviet Union and Germany. And they agreed that if Germany were to attack Poland, that Russia would come in on the other side and they would divide Poland between the two. And that's exactly what happened. Go to the next slide. But
Stalin was, of course, ensconced in the Soviet Union at this point in time.
That's right. He was behind it. Yeah. But both sides sort of tacitly understood that this was not any long-term agreement, that it was temporary. And now, at the same time that all of this talks and the hostilities are developing between the Polish people and the German people, there are about, 2.5 million ethnic Germans living in this Polish corridor inside Poland. And there's a historic...
And you were in the Polish corridor?
Yeah, in the West Prussia.
What was the idea, that this was supposed to cement it as Polish rather than German by killing all the Germans?
Well, they hadn't killed them. They just simply made it a part of Poland. It was West Prussia and Silesia and other areas. But these Germans had lived there for generations.
Yeah. Ben, I'm saying the 58,000 who were murdered, yeah, were Germans living by and large in the Polish corridor.
Yeah.
And was the death of those 58,000 in order to cement Polish control of the Polish corridor?
Well, there was hostility between these Polish, actually the Bolshevik Jews living in Poland and also the Polish people. And so they started to attack these Germans.
Aren't we on the very verge of World War II at this point in time?
And Hitler cannot tolerate this. And
yeah.
So, next slide. Here's some pictures of the murder of these German ethnic Germans in Poles. Here they are. Just go on to the next one. Next slide.
These were principally by being shot.
Yeah, shot.
So don't go too fast.
Yeah.
Chance, go back.
Yeah. And so this is becoming intolerable.
Go back to 108, Chance. I missed. Yeah. Okay. So these are just random killings. This is just taking people out, shooting them in place, Ben.
Sweeping into these German towns and just murdering people. And the total number.
Here's a woman who discovers her husband murdered in her very home. Let's look at the map and let's stop there. That's clearly the right place for us to stop.
Okay.
And this is a German invasion of Poland because of the intolerable situation, including the slaughter of 58,000 Germans.
Right. But Great Britain and France have given Poland a blank check. They said, if Germany invades, we will declare war on Germany.
Ben, you've done a great job of bringing us up to the beginning of World War II. I can't thank you enough. I'm going to bring you back for part two. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, thanking my special guest, Ben Bradbury, for being here, and all of you for watching.
Hi, my name's Gary King, and I've assembled the most formidable JFK team on planet Earth. We've got Dr. James Fetzer, Larry Rivera, who is the number one researcher in the world today when it comes to new research, and we've got Don Fox, who's not afraid to look a little bit deeper than anyone else. So if you're interested in what happened to the 35th President of the United States, then I invite you to our show. It's called The New JFK Show. And it's on YouTube. Go to Gary King YouTube channel, and we've got over 90 shows archived for you there. So if you really want to know the truth, and knowing that over 9 out of 10 researchers are working the other side of the street in a sea of disinformation, I pledge to you the truth. about JFK, go to Gary King YouTube channel and find out your true history.